Revenue Committee will come to order. Good morning, everyone. We will start off today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 777. Senator Gelser is here. I'll ask her to step up while we get an update and briefing from our administrator, economist Christina.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Senate Bill 777 would direct the Oregon 529 Savings Board to establish by rule a state achieving a better life experience or ABLE program. It allows persons with disabilities to establish savings accounts for their disability-related expenses. And it would exclude both contributions to and distributions from the account for qualified disability expenses from federal taxable income. It would provide for the taxation of distributions that are not for qualified disability expenses. The measure also adds a representative of persons with disabilities to the Oregon 529 Savings Board to be appointed by the treasurer, and it removes the requirement that a representative of the State Board of Higher Education serve on the 529 Savings Board, and also removes the requirement that the Oregon University System provide administrative staff to the board. And there's a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
And this has already been in another committee?
Yes, it came from a higher ed committee.
Okay. Kind of a circuitous route.
It actually was not in the higher ed committee. It was in the Human Services and Early Childhood Committee.
Okay. Senator Gelser.
All right. Great. Thank you for your record. My name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which is Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, and surrounding areas. And I'm really happy to be here with you today to talk about our lucky bill, Lucky 7, Senate Bill 777. Last December, a miraculous thing happened. Our Congress passed a bill, and the president signed it. And included in that bill was actually something really good, the ABLE Act. This is something that's been in the works at the federal level for years and years and years. And it's designed to address a problem that people with disabilities face in trying to move out of poverty and to accumulate assets. Under federal law, to maintain your eligibility for benefits, not just cash benefits, but disability-related benefits like job coaching and support, in-home support, you can never have assets that exceed $2,000. That makes it impossible to save up enough money to make a first and last month rent deposit, to save enough money for a home, to repair your wheelchair, to pay for medications that may not be covered by your insurance. If you can imagine never being able to save and hold on to more than $2,000 for an emergency, you can see how that really limits your opportunities. For parents that find themselves blessed with children with disabilities, they also face an unusual circumstance. Usually when you have a baby, everybody comes and talks to you about saving for your child's future. You might invest in a 529 college savings plan. You might invest in life insurance. You might start a savings account. You might start a trust. When you have a child with a disability, what you are told is whatever you do, do not save any money for this child. Do not put any money away for this child. Do not include this child in your will. Do not allow grandparents to save any money for your children. And that means as parents, we have to treat our disabled children differently than we treat our non-disabled children. There is a mechanism where you can set up a special needs trust, but the distributions and the use of the money in that trust is very limited. For instance, a special needs trust cannot be used for housing. It can't be used for medical care. So you're always focused only on those resources that are provided through public assistance. Senate Bill 777 allows individuals with disabilities to be able to plan for more independence, to set and meet financial goals. It allows adults with disabilities to work for better wages because they will be able to save some of the money that they are earning. Virginia so far is the only state that has signed this bill into law. There are 20 states right now that are considering the legislation. If we are able to get this moved over to Ways and Means and to the governor's desk, we have a really good shot at being the second state in the country to set this up. And even though we would be the second state to pass it, we are in a really good position to be the first state to get it going. One of the unusual aspects of the federal legislation is that even though it's about a federal benefit, families and individuals with disabilities can only take advantage of it if their state passes legislation to allow it. You can only invest in an ABLE Act account that's established in the state that the disabled person lives in. In terms of who's eligible, to be eligible, you have to have a disability that manifested before the age of 26. This is a narrower population than every kid that might claim, for instance, the child with a disability tax credit, which is based on having an IEP. These are kids with lifelong, very significant disabilities. Adults can also save for themselves if they're, and you'll hear from some folks today who will talk to you about why they want to be able to save the money that they've earned, as long as that disability was identified before the age of 26. There are some limits on how the money can be used, and you can accumulate up to $100,000 a year, or up to $100,000 in the savings account before you start to lose your benefits. At that point, you still don't lose your Medicaid benefits, which can be very important for accessing that medical care. It would be limited to the federal gift limit each calendar year, which is currently about $14,000. I'm going to turn it over to Michael Parker in a second here, but I really want to thank him for the work that he's done. The reason that we could be the first to have these established for our families, even though we may be the second to sign it into law, is that he has been working diligently on this since really even before the law passed. He's been talking to other states. He's been talking with financial administrators to get the best deal possible for our families. Treasurer Wheeler also has been incredibly supportive. The night that President Obama signed the bill into law, it was probably within 5 minutes that the news release went out from the White House. My phone rang at home, and Treasurer Wheeler said, let's get the bill in. Let's get this thing done. So I've been very grateful for the follow through, and you're going to hear from families that are going to make you all want to sign on to the bill, just like everybody did in the last committee that had the bill. So thank you for considering it, and I hope we can move it on to Ways and Means as soon as possible.
Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. I'll be very, very brief. Senator Gelster did a great job of giving you an idea of what this bill can do. But she made one very important point, and that is we can only move this along, and people can only invest in this if the state passes a law. And here at the Oregon College Savings Network, we're prepared, I think, to start working on this immediately as soon as this bill gets signed into law. We have a number of contracts with financial managers that can help us put this bill together. We have a long experience, 15 years of working on these plans. As you may or may not know, the College Savings Network has about $2.3 billion in it currently. So a long history, good experience of putting these plans together. We kind of know the pitfalls and things, what to do and what not to do. And I'm happy to work with the Legislative Revenue Office to work on the revenue impact if you need additional information. So again, just here to let you know that the network is prepared to put this bill into place as soon as it passes.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, you're a co-sponsor of this?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Haas. My name is Cedric Hayden. I'm State Representative from House District 7. I am a Republican as the Vice Chair of the House Health Care Committee. This bill has been of a lot of interest to me. We've been tracking it through Congress. It has taken about 8 years to get to where it's at now. So over the years of watching that development take place, I was excited to see in December that this actually became something that Oregon could work on. As a co-sponsor of the bill, I just want to support it. I think what's been presented here is a very good possibility or opportunity for parents and adults that have had a disability that can be documented prior to the age of 26 years old, that they can now put some funds aside before, probably as was presented here, if people with disabilities were able to work and save money, they could only save $2,000 or they would have to give it away. So there's no way that they could even save money, say, for a van that would help them with transportation. So it's important that they're able to have that money and still keep the services that are available to them. This would allow them to save up to $100,000 and still keep their Social Security benefits, SSI benefits that they have available to them. So it's an important bill. It's something that I support. It is probably important to note that I'm not only somebody that will utilize this bill from the political perspective as something that's very, very important or promote the bill. I'm also a father of a special needs child, and so it's something that I've tracked closely and hope to get your support.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, two more pieces to add. The revenue impact will come from the bill would allow the same tax benefits for investing in an Oregon 529 savings plan for your disabled child as for your non-disabled child. When we crafted the bill, we felt that was a matter of equity, that when families are establishing these 529 plans, if we have established tax incentives for families to do that, we shouldn't differentiate between children. It was just a matter of fairness. The fiscal impact on the bill, it will cost money, of course, to do the outreach and set things up. However, it is not going to require a general fund allocation because the 529 plan is going to be able to lend that money to themselves and be able to then move that forward and pay themselves back.
So am I right? In addition to a tax deduction on the state side, there's a similar dynamic on the federal side, which we don't have on the other 529.
The tax benefits within the ABLE Act will be the same as they will be on the current 529 plan. So you get everything will grow state and federally tax-free, and as Senator Gelser mentioned, we're asking for the upfront tax deduction. So it'll be the tax benefits will be exactly the same both federally and state.
That's right. They can grow tax-free.
Correct.
But there's the state tax deduction
Correct.
That you get. There's not a federal tax.
There's no federal deduction, just the tax-free growth.
And the revenue impact for the current 529 system is about $8 million?
It's about $8 million a biennium. That's correct.
Okay. Yep. But the numbers, I'm guessing, will be much smaller because of the population.
Senator Hess, we expect it to be smaller because you've got a smaller pool of folks that are going to use the plan, so it's not quite as broad.
Yeah.
And it's always a tension in that. I don't think it will be as big. I've been surprised by the level of communication from people across the state that are interested in doing this. I think it's important to note all three of us here are parents that probably would have invested in a 529 ABLE plan for our kids. My kid's now too old, but
mine's not.
Yours is not. So I'm very excited about this bill. The opportunity to really build a brighter future that lifts people with disabilities out of poverty. This bill will be one of the most significant things that we can do and that we have done for individuals with disabilities in this legislature.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess first I'll declare a conflict of interest. I must be close to. I see Senator Gelser's opted out, and I'm guessing Representative Hayden's probably still in with me. The question I have for, I guess, the panel, it's a great idea, but I'm absolutely stunned at the fiscal. I mean, the fact that you're going to take, you would have to loan the money of $900,000 in the first biennium, and then steady state to come out of the funds that should be going to the disabled savings is almost $700,000 a biennium for managing it. That's a lot of money, considering probably the level of individuals who are in. I mean, it's a great idea, the federal thing, but I'm just, why is the fiscal just so outrageous is the exact word.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the current fiscal for the 15-17 biennium is for two positions. We are not anticipating marketing this plan like we do the college savings plan as far as doing media and that kind of thing. We're really going to focus on a grassroots effort to get the word out to those groups that are working with disabled individuals. So the fiscal really is for two positions, one outreach position that's going to basically be the marketing arm for the contact arm for the ABLE plan, and an admin position to do a lot of the administrative functions that are going to be required for ABLE. Included in that fiscal is also about $300,000 just to get everything, all the materials built and made, everything kind of set up. That $300,000 we anticipate to go away in the second biennium. So the go-forward fiscal really is going to be for positions, not a lot. We're not going to spend a ton of money on that marketing aspect of the plan. We're really going to use people to do that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm looking at the fiscal. So the 17-19 cost that has to come out of the money that parents are going to have to put into this thing is $673,000. I don't know what interest rate you're going to have to get and how many people are going to have in it, but I mean, we need to figure out a way to help. I mean, I'm totally with Senator Gelser. We've been screwing over the disabled for so long, especially on the federal side, this whole $2,000 limit, so they can't even save money for a wheelchair. I mean, I'm with you on that one, but I'm looking at this fiscal at $673,673 as the steady state. That's got to come out of what the parents and the interest and the earnings of this account would be, and I'm assuming this is going to be pooled just at the statewide. So the amount of money that's got to go into this just to pay the bureaucrats is up there.
And if I might, I think one of, and I don't do fiscals, but I do think that it is very important, especially in the early years, to have an administrator that's administrating this plan. The risks to families in making a mistake and having a distribution from the account and making an expenditure that's somehow not allowed under the rules could put at risk their benefits or put them at risk for needing to repay the federal government a lot of money. So I think this initial investment in doing this the right way, reaching out, making sure that we're reaching a diverse group of families. I mean, the families that this impacts stretch across all socioeconomic levels, all races, all parts of the state. And I think that's a lot of work in that first couple of biennia.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And about this fiscal, it's going to come out of the plan. And this is money that these folks are going to put into the plan that they wouldn't be even allowed to have otherwise. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, the fiscal is paid by the folks that are in the plan, exactly the same as the 529 plan is today. So you're investing in the 529 plan. A small portion of your money goes to pay for all the services that you get provided. Exactly the same principle works here. The reason that the 529 plan is loaning the money initially because we have no assets in there initially. When we started the 529 plan 15 years ago, the state loaned us the money. The general fund loaned us the money. Since we have a very robust plan, we have some dollars that we can loan to ourselves. So in this instance, we'll loan that money. Folks will invest in the plan, and over time, the loan will be paid back. And then it is the goal to have the current investors sustain the plan with their annual fees.
But follow-up, but that didn't really answer the question that I asked, which is the money that that folks invest in this plan would be money that they wouldn't even be allowed to keep otherwise. Is that correct?
Senator Riley, that is correct. Because of the new federal law, they're allowed to keep more assets in this plan than they would have normally before the law was passed.
And without the law, you're correct, they would not be able to keep that money at all.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming forward. Senator Gelser, you continue to be a champion in this category. We salute you.
Thank you.
We have a long list of people who are interested in speaking on this. Let's start with Joey Rosano, Jeff Krueger, and Alicia Delishman. If you have written testimony, don't feel the need to read it. We have it, and it'll be entered into the record. Just give us your highlights and speak from the heart.
Good morning. Chair Senator Haas and the State Senate Revenue Committee, my name is Joey Rosano. This is my beautiful daughter, Jade. And I represent the families that Senator Gelser was talking about when she said that we were one of the ones to get the advice about not saving. So my daughter has a developmental delay, which doesn't show up until about age two. It's called Rett syndrome. So when she was born, normally she has a brother and a sister. We set up 529 accounts for all three of our children, as did my parents, because that's what you do for grandchildren. You take care of them. Then she was diagnosed with Rett syndrome. It's like having a child with autism, cerebral palsy, Parkinson's, epilepsy, and an anxiety disorder all in one. So clearly she has a lot of challenges ahead of her. But the one thing she can do is communicate her wishes. So we started going to lots of different conferences and that kind of thing. And the one thing that they told us was, you cannot leave her any money. You cannot leave her even a 529. Because if you do, when she turns 18, or if, God forbid, something should happen to you, you will be denying her federal benefits. And I think as a parent, that's one of the worst things that that we could imagine. So we went to a lawyer, and we said, let's set up this special needs trust. He said, okay, well, we're going to start you off with $10,000, and then there's going to be fees to maintain it and everything else. Well, we are in the throes of disability. $10,000 is absolutely untenable for our family. So it was complex. In addition to that, we did set up our will, however, to specifically exclude her from anything, any kind of life insurance, any kind of living expenses as well. And I'm here to tell you, that was one of the most difficult days of my life, is telling my lawyer to exclude my six-year-old from any kind of financial gain upon my death. We did set up that will, and I felt punished for having a child with a disability. I thought it was really unfair that I could save for her brother and sister, but that I couldn't save for her. This ABLE Act, as Senator Boko said, it's terrific. It's a game changer. Families won't have to make the hard decisions that I've had to make. And to be honest, if it does pass, I will gladly put her back in my will. Instead, they'll have ABLE accounts to support not only our children with disabilities. They can get a job. They can go to school. They can arrange for transportation. I have a vision. She has a vision that she wants to live on her own in a real community at some point in her life. She wants to have her own apartment and a personal care worker so that she can go do the things that allow her to be part of her community. That particular step is how many of us discovered our own voice to build our own community and support system. She wants that, and now if we pass this, we can help her get that too. Since you already have my written testimony, I'll just say that if there's anything I know about my daughter, she may not have an actual voice, but she does deserve a choice. The ABLE Act and Senate Bill 777 will truly improve her life and the lives of Oregonians with disabilities. Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Kruger. I'm from Portland. I'm here to testify in support, or on behalf of my daughter, Karina, in support of the passage of Senate Bill 777. My daughter also has Rett syndrome. I'm the father of two children, Mike, who's in second grade, and my daughter, Karina, who's in kindergarten. We also experienced the same sort of issues that Joey just mentioned. We started saving for our son's college education, basically the moment he was born, and put money into the Oregon College Savings Plan. And we quickly realized after our daughter was diagnosed with her disability at age two, or approximately age two, that we wouldn't be able to do the same sorts of savings opportunities that we did for our son. Essentially, we can save for our son's college education and the expenses to prepare him for a future in life. But under the current law, both federal and state, we're not able to save for the expenses that our daughter will have for her disability-related expenses. Those expenses are most likely going to far exceed during her lifetime the expenses that it costs to send our son to college, regardless of whether we send our kid to a state college or a private college. Probably the disability-related expenses our daughter will experience will exceed what you could ever imagine paying for an education at the most expensive private colleges in the country. So from my perspective, it's an issue of fundamental fairness and empowerment of families. An ABLE Act at the Oregon level would allow us to save our own money and our family members to save our own money to provide for a better future for our daughter. It will help her experience great things in life, and I'll give you a few examples in a minute of things that she does now, which are potentially going to be challenging in the future if we don't have an ABLE account for her benefit. The examples include situations where we'll be able to take burdens off of other family members who are currently involved in Karina's life. She has two very involved grandparents who are both in their one will be 70 this summer and one will be 71 just at the end of this month. Both of them are involved in her life on a daily basis, but one of the activities that they do for our daughter is they take her to the community swimming pool every week. We have a van. It's not wheelchair accessible. It's not really accessible for folks with disabilities, and Karina has significant physical challenges that she faces. As my parents age, they won't be able to really transport her back and forth from the community swimming pool, and she won't be able to have those experiences with her grandparents and also with the community at large. We've received estimates that a modification to our van that we have would be approximately $10,000. An Oregon Able account would allow our family to save our own money, to save up for the expenses that would be needed to modify the van to allow her to continue to experience these life experiences with her family and the community. She's also in the same, or was in the same preschool as our son, and is in the same elementary school as our son is now. In that context, she doesn't participate in the same manner that our son participates. She needs supports in order to participate and gain the educational benefits from those experiences that other kids get. She has a paraeducator at school. She receives physical and some physical and some speech therapy from the school, but it's not a great deal of level of services from the school district. We have her in private speech therapy and private physical therapy. An Oregon Able account would allow us to save our own money to provide for those sorts of supplemental therapies that she doesn't get from government services. So it's something that the ABLE Act will allow us to enhance her experiences both in the school setting and outside of the school setting, and her integration with other members of her family. So I'd encourage you to pass Senate Bill 777.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Alicia DeLashmet. My daughter just turned 13. Her name is Neva. She's a middle schooler at Trillium Public Charter School in Portland, and she loves a lot of the things that girls her age love, music and sports and eating pizza and hanging out with her friends. There's a lot of ways that Neva differs from her typically developing peers as well. She has a rare genetic syndrome called Moat-Wilson. It's resulted in global developmental delays. And what this means for her is that she needs assistance in all aspects of daily life, such as toileting and eating and bathing, dressing. She needs assistance to keep her safe, and she needs to use augmentative communication to talk with her friends. As you can imagine, there are a lot of challenges to raise a child like Neva, helping her to avoid health setbacks, avoid bullying, gaining access to a good education. Some of these challenges are very normal. We can handle that as a family. But some of the challenges are related to the very systems that are put in place to help support her and guarantee her well-being. In order for her to remain qualified for those essential services, such as SSI or Medicaid, she can't have more than $2,000 in savings, as we've discussed. And what this means for parents of kids like Neva is that we have to diligently and vigilantly impoverish our own kids. And when grandparents want to leave a savings bond or an inheritance to their other grandchildren, I have to say you can't do that for Neva. You can't give her a savings bond like you're giving to her cousins. You can't treat her the same way that you treat the other grandchildren. And many of you have had children or maybe have children that you've saved for college and college savings accounts. So imagine that you can only save up to $2,000 for college. Now imagine that college is really not just for 4 or 5 years of school. It's for their basic needs for the rest of their life. And that's what we've had to support, or that's what we've had to face before the ABLE Act. Prior to the passage of the ABLE Act, the only way that we could accumulate more than $2,000 is to set up a special needs trust. This is a legal instrument. It's costly to set up, it's costly to maintain, and it's very complex. It needs to be constantly updated based on the changes of law, and it's really difficult to administer. What we want for our kid is the same thing that everybody wants for their children. We want a good place to live. We want a suitable job. We want a good education opportunity, healthy and meaningful life, a way for her to give back to her community. And the implementation of the ABLE Act in Oregon helps us invest in our daughter's future in a really simple and sensible way. So I urge you, please, to pass Senate Bill 777 and sign it into law. Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. Hold on, is there any question? Any questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you. Ms. Rizzuto, is that right?
Rizzuto.
Close enough?
Yeah.
Okay. I heard you say that you would put her back in your will.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that to do that, you'd have to say, put the her inheritance in the ABLE account. You couldn't actually give her the inheritance. Is that correct?
That's correct. It currently is directed. We have life insurance policies so that upon our death, the life insurance policies will then set up the special needs trust.
Mm-hmm.
But we would gladly put it in the 529 if we could do that.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good Thank testimony. You.
Justin Connolly, Karen Lindell, and Rachel Simpson, please.
Hi, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I am Rachel Simpson, and I truly apologize if I get weepy. I am a supporter of the ABLE Act because I have a job. I would like to save, but as you heard in the other testimonies, people can only save a certain amount for their loved one. What I struggle with on a daily basis, I struggle with getting a van. Right now, I don't have the ways and means to have a real reliable van. Plus, I don't have a house to call my own. I would like to live on my own because with a house, living on my own, that would mean I would be able to have a normal freedom life. Right now, because of the house, my housing situation, I have to either have somebody, a roommate, or somebody else living with me, because for disabled people, it doesn't work very well when they live on their own. Right now, we are trying to figure out how I can live by myself, but it's impossible. Having my own house would help a lot. One of the other things you do not see me is my wheelchair is broken. My wheelchair usually stands up and sits down, but as of right now, my insurance does not pay for the overcost of my standing portion. Please, I urge you to pass the 777 bill. Also, something else you don't see is I am legally blind. I wish to have a guide dog someday. But as of right now, I cannot have a guide dog because they're way too expensive. The price for a guide dog would be $9,000. This would help me. I would need help from the guide dog to walk on curbs and just have a regular life. Right now, I can't even walk to the store by myself because I can't even see the curbs. Please, I urge you from the bottom of my heart for these people back behind me to pass the 777 bill, and for these folks beside me to pass it to. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi, my name is Justin Connolly. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I am a member of the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 777.
My name is... Oh.
I'm still speaking. It is important to me to save extra funding for housing and transportation costs. I live independently on my own in my own apartment. I have lived independently since 1998. I have not been able to live in a nice or my own home. Instead, I've lived in worn-down homes that are unsafe. Many of these homes are not accessible, nor do they meet my needs. I want something that meets my needs that is affordable and livable. My dream is to save money to make a deposit to move into a place that meets my needs. If the ABLE Act passed, I'd be able to save enough to meet my housing needs and live independently. Thank you for your time. Now I will be supporting Karen in her testimony by asking her questions. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Karen. I live in North and Northeast Portland. I am the OSAC on the OSAC committee meeting, and I work for Senator Chip.
Okay. Questions. Why is it important to save money?
To save money, you want to put your asset in the bank and you want to save so when your parents are not around, you can live independent like anybody else who has a disability. Who doesn't have a disability.
How does saving money help you live independently?
It saves because while you want to build your asset up, so when your family are not around, you can save, and it will help you to live independent without your family around when they are not longer around.
How could saving money help you pay for your health costs?
It will save because why is really important because why it will save when you go to the dentist, you have to pay out of pocket, you have to pay your dentist appointments out of pocket, you have to pay your eye appointments because I have a glaucoma, and glaucoma can be very bad for your eyes because you might have to have laser surgery, and then for your doctor's appointment and for your even when you go to buy description, it's very costly. You know, we all have to realize that we all have people who's out in the community who needs that support. So please pass the bill, because why we really want it, because it will help Oregonians to make a better future and a better lives for when their parents are not around. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You all did a great job.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else signed up to speak on Senate Bill 777? Well, I want to thank the families here for coming forward, for your courage in everything that you do. And I can tell you that there's not a committee member up here who's not rooting for you and cheering you on. I'm confident that when we get our paperwork in order, we will move this bill forward. And I'm optimistic that this bill will prevail and pass, not because of the big shots involved, but because of the families who are here making their presence known in this committee and others. So thank you all. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 777, and we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 807.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 807 would establish criteria for either cities or counties to be designated as job creation zones. It provides that once an area is designated a job creation zone, the zone would remain for 10 years, even if it stops meeting the requirements. It prohibits the taxation of capital gains for residents of the job creation zones, allows the city or county designated as a job creation zone to waive any state regulation if the cost of compliance is greater than $100,000 for individuals and businesses within the zone, and that the purpose of the regulation could be achieved through more cost-effective means. It makes some changes to the income tax rates for the residents of job creation zones, basically widening the 5 and 7% brackets. Also provides for an inflation adjustment of the new amounts. It extends the rates for non-passive income attributable to any partnership or S corporation to sole proprietorships, single member limited liability companies, or other pass through entities that are located in the job creation zones. It also provides for an inflation increase of the income brackets. It changes the criteria for businesses which may enter a qualifying investment contract with the governor, and creates a non-refundable tax credit for businesses at 50% of the cost of providing paid family leave, paid sick time, or flex time to employees working in a job creation zone. It also establishes the Oregon Empowerment Scholarship Program to fund qualified expenses for post-secondary education for students in the zones. It requires the state treasurer to create a separate account for each participating student and fund it with an amount equal to 90% of the statewide average distribution to the state school fund per student. And it requires the state treasurer to transfer 5% of the statewide average distribution to the school district in which the student resides, and up to 4% of the statewide average distribution to a Department of Education empowerment account. And it establishes this account.
This is Senator Ferrioli's bill, and he couldn't make it today, but Steve, would you like to comment on this?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Steve Elzinga, and I'm here on behalf of Senator Ferrioli, who apologizes for not being able to make it today. Senate Bill 807 is an unapologetic attempt to create family wage jobs and improve the economy in rural Oregon, and especially in areas that are struggling with high poverty, sustained high unemployment, and sustained population decline. Unfortunately, many of Oregon's policies and regulations are designed with the metro area in mind and so they don't work quite as well in rural Oregon areas. And this bill responds to that by empowering local communities, cities, and counties by giving them the tools to attract and retain good family wage jobs in many areas that have been struggling economically for decades. Strong action needs to be taken. And so SB 807 recognizes that metro-centric, one-size-fits-all regulations have inhibited job creation in rural Oregon for too long and helps create the opportunity for rural communities to take needed action to spur economic recovery. SB 807 will create family wage jobs in rural Oregon, which will benefit all of Oregon by helping fund education, public safety, and other essential services. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for Steve on this measure?
Well, it's a interesting, Ferrioli-esque, colorful, creative idea, as always. Questions? Steve, thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Sure. Senator Boquist?
not a question, Steve, just a comment. I mean, I think that one of the words is it's a potpourri of ideas. In fact, a lot of the ideas that, interesting enough, you and I have discussed some of these.
Yeah, I saw it.
And so I think it's one of those menu items that, you know, we need to look at some of these items on the menu. And I think every member of the committee, we've had this rural discussion, you know, due to congestion and other things, we'd like to see more rural development happening outside the edges. And some of the ideas that are in here, actually in other places, and as we continue some of our other discussions, maybe some of these will to rise to the occasion for inserting into other locations and actions we plan to take.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. I have a couple of people who would like to weigh in here, Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly.
Senator Hassan, committee, for the record, Jody Weiser of Tax Fairness Oregon. This bill was just described as something that would help benefit rural Oregon. But if you look at what it takes to qualify, if you start in the year 1976, I didn't look prior to that because I didn't easily find history of unemployment figures for the state of Oregon. But if you start in 1976, for the next 45 years, ending in 2021, the whole state of Oregon would be eligible for the provisions of this bill, except for 8 years. Because was the unemployment rate below 7%, above 7% for 2 years, and then for the 10-year period after that, and only from 1997 to 2004 would not the whole state of Oregon be included. So this is not going to help rural Oregon. It's going to starve government in a thousand different ways. In looking at the various provisions, we didn't really see any that you need to act on, but it is a good warning system for what might be proposed for whatever the grand bargain is this year, the exquisite bargain or the paltry bargain or however it ends up to be. There are many things in here that are objectionable. For instance, for the whole state, there would be a capital gains tax break. It wouldn't matter whether it was me investing in the stock market as long as I lived in the state. For that period of time that we're talking about, if you assume that going forward, that pretty much means it's a capital gains tax break for everybody. That there are income tax reductions for every citizen in one of these zones. I think it was 2012, we enacted the reduced income taxes for non-active businesses. This legislation takes out the requirement that there be even one part-time job. I remember you arguing over that and it getting down to one part-time job for a person who wasn't a business owner. I would guess that with that provision, I could form an LLC, put all my assets in it, and spend a bit of time every month managing the money and be able to not pay any capital gains, pay reduced rates on all my capital gains income under that. It means that the state coffers would pay one half the cost of sick leave at HB and the Bank of America, at McDonald's and Wind Farms, and as well as at Tufel's Nursery and the Neighborhood Coffee House. There's also provisions about education subsidies and making the single sales factor promise good for virtually any business for 30 years. It's quite a menu of options. And we assume you're hearing the bill to kind of be aware of what those options are and be ready for them in the bargaining at the end of the session, because we can't see any other reason why you would be hearing this menu of possibilities. Thank you.
Marcia. Chair Huston, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And I echo, I believe, Senator Boquist's description of a potpourri of ideas, which are difficult to get the complete ramifications without any actual figures. And I understand that it's just a public hearing, so not put for a work session. You can see that there are problems with enacting something that then carries out for 10 years, even if the conditions do not exist. So for a period of time, you might have unemployment at that level, and then that condition doesn't exist, but the provisions carry forward for 10 years. It's nice to know that the proponents think that paid sick time is fine, but it's my understanding that if you have employees and you pay for sick time, those are expenses that can be deducted from your taxes when you are filing your taxes. As a small business owner 10 years ago, I had to do all of the things because I had 3 employees. And paid sick time, if enacted, should be treated just like any other business expense, and it should not be a privilege for those people who will offer it versus people who might not offer it. It would be better to have paid sick time involved. There are so many complications in this bill that my eyes just roll trying to read through it. I have real concerns about some of the education provisions. We have a motto outside the Capitol that talks about distributing resources equitably, and I think that this bill goes against that. Rural Oregon is benefiting from things that happen in the metro areas only because of the state school fund. So this bill just seems to have no real traction, as far as I'm concerned.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you. So I hear what you're both saying. I don't think this bill is ready to go, but I'm getting frustrated by everybody. Every time an idea is put forward, just everybody piles on and says why we can't do it. And I haven't heard a whole lot of people trying to get to yes on these type of things. We heard, not this bill, but some of the concepts that were related and that are actually contained in this bill were also in Senate Bill, I think it was 748, which I heard in my committee, in Environment and Natural Resources Committee a couple of days ago. And that bill in its current form is not going to be moving forward this session, but some of the concepts contained within may, and it's simply an effort in our land use planning system to allow rural counties that literally don't have the resources, you know, where the county planner is also the librarian and the receptionist, and you know, they wear many hats, and they're not necessarily planning experts, and so the requirements that we have laid upon them to be able to meet, if an opportunity were to come knocking, they're just really onerous, and they're unrealistic. And I have been vocal in my committee at saying, look, I don't think that it's Oregon's land use planning system that has caused poverty in rural Oregon. It is a national and an international trend. I just don't think that Oregon's land use planning system ought to stand in the way if an opportunity comes. And so while I don't think that this bill as currently constructed is ready to go, I would like, you know, some thoughtful consideration about what the legislature can do with these types of concepts, not all of them, but some of these things, to allow our rural counties to be able to at least make an attempt at prospering. We just voted on a terrible, in my view, a terrible K-12 budget. And I didn't want to vote for it, but I voted for it because at the end of the day, my assessment in looking at what was driving that was really about our human service caseload numbers. And that's driven by both demographics and poverty. And that's not going to change unless we can start doing something to drive growth both in average income and economic growth in our rural areas. And so I'm venting on you, good people. I don't, you know, but, you know, we have to, just because we haven't passed anything out of the Environment Natural Resources Committee yet that addresses these issues, or somewhat, doesn't mean that we won't. And you know, we can always fill a room with naysayers on everything, and so the status quo just continues. And I appreciate the chair at least hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator Edwards.
I'll get off my soapbox now.
It's okay.
I respond to your
sure.
Chair Haas and Senator Edwards? One of my other hats I wear, I'm a small-time local elected official, and we belong to the Council of Governments for this area. And the Council of Governments has on their staff people who help the small cities in doing planning and transportation planning and all of those things. And possibly the state could create something that's not LCDC, but something where there are a pot of people who can help on those opportunity grants and make sure that something is set aside for some of that planning to make things available so that they would have that staffing. It's just a sort of thought outside of the box. I do note that I did not say anything about land use planning when I was doing testimony. I'm thinking that there are just lots of little things in here, especially on the education, that was very confusing, and setting up a program that's probably already set up.
Thank you both. No one else is here to testify on Senate Bill 807, so we'll close that hearing. And there's no other business before us. So stand by one. Dr. Warner, will you please take the witness stand?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. Just wanted to remind you that tomorrow is our first meeting of the Joint Tax Credit Committee. So it'll be in this room at 8:30, but you'll have a different seating arrangement because you'll be joined by the 9 members of House Revenue Committee. So we'll go through the organizational aspects of it. We'll give an overview of the bills that are in your in that joint committee, and then we'll proceed with a schedule probably roughly once a week or every other week for the next month or two. So just to keep that in mind, we'll be using the Senate time for our meetings.
Paul, have any of the numbers changed in so much as the tax credits that will expire total about $65 million? The co-chairs have given us $14 million to spend on those expiring tax credits.
Mr. Chair, those basic numbers remain the same. We are seeing very extensive work done in some of the policy committees that are combining credits, for example, that are not extending, they're not sending them on to the Joint Tax Committee or modifying existing credits. So you'll see kind of a lot of work that's been done. And we're expecting to have the chairs of those committees come and brief you on the work that they've done in the policy committees to kind of get that process started. But the overall numbers in terms of what it would cost to extend those credits in their current form is the same. It's about $65 million.
Chair, I also believe there's new credits, so I'm hopeful that Dr. Warner and crew will, before we start down the decision-making process, have a matrix or a laundry list of what all is on there. And just for the record, Mr. Chair, the $14 million is an impossible task, so it might just turn out that the Revenue Committee goes toe-to-toe with Joint Ways and Means and says, go back to your drawing board and start figuring.
But yes, Senator Boquist, the comment is correct. As you remember, your committee here has passed on several new credits onto the Joint Tax Committee for consideration.
Mm-hmm. They do every year.
Okay,
I know. That's a wonderful.
Okay.
And they ask for
thank
tax
you, Paul. With no other business before us, we will adjourn. No other business before us, we will adjourn.